Seeing Elmer Bernstein's Academy Award-winning composer's name up there reminds me that he also wrote the Gamecock football fight song, believe it or not. It's true. I don't think you want to hear me sing it, but it's actually stolen from a Broadway show. But Scott Curtis is up first. I should say that about 5 or 6 years ago, I heard him give a paper on a similar topic at a conference that really just greatly influenced the way I was thinking about what we were studying and studying early cinema and cinema itself. And I don't know if I have the argument right, but essentially that the invention of cinematography changed the whole nature and enterprise of scientific research, at least in biology. So he's here from Northwestern University today to give us a talk aptly entitled On Magnification. Scott Curtis.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for bringing me in from sunny Chicago. What does it mean to magnify? As we've just seen, it means, in the simplest sense, to increase the apparent size of an object by technical means, such as with a microscope or a telescope. Through the lens, that which is small and or distant is made to seem larger and hence closer. And when this happens, we have the odd effect of being transported from one place or realm to another, or of the object being brought to us. In powers of 10, especially, we see that magnification implies movement, a movement much like our own attempt to see more clearly by bringing something closer. But the movement that comes with magnification, like that of film or animation itself, is apparent movement, one that is an effect of the technology and not of actual conveyance. Powers of 10 illustrates especially well this idea of magnification as a journey through space. But this grand tour through the universe also implies a certain mastery, the all-encompassing gaze of science, if you will, that, like the effect of movement in animation, may be illusory. Yet we can also speak of magnification of time. Indeed, the German word for slow motion is Zeitlupe, which translates as time magnifying glass. And at this point, I would like to gratefully acknowledge the German people for their conveniently literal language. In what sense is slow motion a magnification of time? What does slow motion have in common with the microscope? Slow motion ostensibly allows us to see more clearly that which moves too quickly. It enlarges time by multiplying its span. It thus effectively slows down time so that we may inspect it. It apparently allows us to see that which is otherwise invisible to our time-bound senses. In other words, the microscope, the telescope, slow motion, and even time-lapse cinematography all have in common the ability to bring that which is beyond human perception within the boundaries or range of our perception or understanding. And this corresponds to older, somewhat archaic uses of the term magnification. One could, for example, magnify people or the Lord. To glorify or extol, to praise or honor, is in one sense to bring an object or person within the bounds of public perception. Macaulay writes, quote, "Everywhere men magnified his valor, genius, and patriotism," unquote. To extol his virtues is to enlarge, or maybe exaggerate, his merits on the public stage, to bring that which might go unnoticed under closer inspection. On the other hand, to magnify the Lord, as in, "When on your knees ye humbly fell and magnified a higher power," means enlarging the realm of one's understanding, or soul, if you prefer, to approximate the dimensions of the divine, while also striving to bring the limitless divine within the realm of human ken. Magnification, in all senses of the word, therefore implies a relation, perhaps even a tension, between human limits and that which lies beyond them, whether it be the divine or infinity. Magnification is the attempt to explore these reaches, a fine example of the struggle between human finitude and infinity. The microscope and telescope apparently open up new worlds of dizzying depths and heights. There is no telling how deep or how high they can go, or how small or how large the units of time can be in slow motion or time-lapse cinematography. Bringing these limitless worlds within our perception, these technologies evoke a sense of wonder, of awe, or perhaps even a pleasurable terror at the infinitesimally small or large. I would therefore like to suggest, in other words, that magnification contains within it the notion of the sublime. The modern concept of the sublime derives from Edmund Burke's 1754 treatise on the subject. Terror, according to Burke, quote, in all cases whatsoever, either more openly or latently, is the ruling principle of the sublime, unquote. Of the many sources of the sublime from Burke's peculiar catalog, we find obscurity, vastness, difficulty, the profusion of the splendid, intensity of light, loudness, the cries of animals, bitter tastes, and intolerable stenches. His book and his list may seem quaint now in an age when intolerable stenches are a rather mundane feature of a walk through any major city. Probably not this one, though. Nevertheless, Burke's philosophical inquiry into the sublime had a profound impact on the aesthetics of Romanticism. As Samuel Monk states in his classic study on the sublime, quote, terror is the first of several qualities that, finding no happy home in the well-planned, orderly, and carefully trimmed domain of neoclassicism, sought and found refuge in the sublime, which constantly gathered to itself ideas and emotions that were to be prominent in the poetry and prose of the Romantic era, unquote. In fact, we could trace a direct path from Burke by way of Kant and Schiller and the Schlegel brothers through Madame de Stael to the French symbolists and thus to modernist poetics. But I will not trace that path today. Sigh of relief. For my purposes, it will be enough to outline some common features associated with the sublime in order to illustrate how they show up in early descriptions of scientific cinematography. But my real goal today is to demonstrate how, through the concepts of magnification in the sublime, we can better understand the philosophical and political importance of scientific cinematography for film theory, especially that of John Epstein and Walter Benjamin. Terror, of course, is only the preliminary reaction to the vastness of nature or to the concept of infinity. According to Burke, the sublime is a mixture of awe or terror and pleasure. The sublime is delightful rather than painful, especially when we experience danger or power at a distance. For Kant and Schiller, however, this mixture of feelings was much more profound because the encounter with the awesome provokes an inward turn in order to find a moral or spiritual equivalent to nature's physical complexity. Schiller says that the sublime is, quote, nature's sensuous means of teaching us that we are more than merely sensuous, unquote. That is, we come to recognize the power and necessity of reason when faced with nature's overwhelming physical power. The classical theories of the sublime all have in common this preoccupation with infinity, or more precisely, the human mind's attempt to come to terms with the infinite. We see this as well in early descriptions of microcinematography. References to the infinite were fairly common in early modern descriptions of telescopic views, think Galileo or Kepler, and to a certain extent in Leeuwenhoek and Hooke's description of microscopic views. But the extra magnification of the projected microscopic image evokes especially hyperbolic expressions of wonder from scientists. This one observer waxes eloquent. To see the microorganism move, evolve, and revolve in the midst of normal cells, the spirochetes uncoil and undulate in the fluids which they inhabit, to see them hide behind the blood corpuscles or in clumps of fibrin, turn, twist, and rotate inside a red corpuscle as if in a cage, to see them apparently screw into each other as in a strange conjunction, to see trypanosomes moving back and forth in every direction, displaying their delicate, undulating membrane, shoving aside the blood cells that are in their way, while up by their side, the leukocytes lazily extend or retract their protoplasmic pseudopods. Is to realize that we are in the presence of an unknown world, a world of the infinitesimally small, but a world as real and as complex as that which is visible to our eyes. Or similarly, we have this description from a scientist who has encountered time-lapse films of tissue culture, apparently for the first time. "It was one of the most amazing things I ever saw," Professor Green said. "The film of the growth of the tissue was taken during 24 hours and must have involved a vast amount of reel. What takes place in the 24 hours is reduced to a comparatively few minutes. You see on the screen a growth and a development, nothing short of cosmic. Combustions, spirals, pulsations, all the marvels of biology seem to condense themselves into those few moments." These films of cell life contain within them a fascinating paradox, that a world so small could have cosmic dimensions and implications, that a cinematic record of glacially slow cell time, recorded in the smallest possible increments, could result in the impression of an almost frightening acceleration of life. The encounter with this new world can be terrifyingly pleasurable as well, as in this flourish from W.K.L. Dixon. "The enlargement of animalculae in a drop of stagnant water proved a most exacting task, but the obstacles were overcome and the final results were such as fully to compensate for the expenditure of time and trouble. A series of inch-large shapes then springs into view, magnified stereoptically to nearly 3 feet each, gruesome beyond the power of expression, and exhibiting indescribable celerity and rage. Monsters close upon each other in a blind and indiscriminate attack. Limbs are dismembered. Gory globules are tapped. Whole battalions disappear from view. Investigations in this line, while enriching the general mental store, are scarcely conducive to domestic comfort. An unseen enemy is usually voted to be peculiarly undesirable. But who would not close their eyes to the unimaginable horrors which microphotography reveals in connection with the kinetoscope?" Here we have a demonstration of microcinematography as the quintessential cinema of attractions, a performance that is both horrifying and thrilling. What is unimaginable here, what is beyond understanding, is not simply that these tiny creatures become monsters, once magnified and with projection magnified again. No, what is particularly sublime for Dixon is the combination of magnification and movement. As if movement inward, implied by magnification, is multiplied by movement within or across the frame as well. In other words, what sends a shiver up the spine of scientist and showman alike is a sense of infinite depth implied by magnification, as well as the sense of infinite breadth outside the boundaries of the frame, implied by motion within it. Who better to celebrate movement and magnification than Jean Epstein, the French filmmaker and theorist, who saw in this combination the nature of cinema itself? In his slippery concept of photogenie, we find his ideas about cinematic specificity. I don't want to rehearse the theory for you here, but if you're familiar with it, you'll agree that magnification and movement are the foundation for what he considers to be specific to cinema. Here he raves about the close-up, sounding remarkably like that scientist who waxed eloquent. "A head suddenly appears on screen, and drama, now face to face, seems to address me personally and swells with extraordinary intensity. I'm hypnotized. Now the tragedy is anatomical. The decor of the fifth act is this corner of cheek torn by a smile. Waiting for the moment when 1,000 meters of intrigue converge in a muscular denouement satisfies me more than the rest of the film. Some muscular preambles ripple beneath the skin. Shadows shift, tremble, hesitate. Something is being decided. The close-up, the keystone of cinema, is the maximum expression of this photogenie of movement. When static, it verges on contradiction. The face alone doesn't unravel its expressions, but the head and lens moving together or apart to the left and right of each other. The close-up is an intensifying agent because of its size alone. This magnification acts on one's feelings more to transform than to confirm them. And personally, it makes me uneasy. So photogenie, Epstein's elusive essence of cinema, seems to reside in the momentary flicker of movement and emotion magnified. But there are two things to note here. First, this magnification makes Jean a bit uneasy. It's great, it's a thrill to be sure, but it transforms more than confirms. That is, magnification disturbs. And here we come to another important aspect of the sublime, its threat to the status quo. Unlike the category of the beautiful, which Burke, Kant, and Schiller associate with form, limitation, and order, the sublime evokes the abyss, the chaotic, the boundless. Epstein again. Slow motion and fast motion reveal a world where the kingdom of nature know no boundaries. Everything is alive. Crystals become larger, growing on top of another, smoothly uniting out something in something like sympathy. These experiments contradict and throw into confusion the sense of order which we have established at great cost in our conception of the universe. Not without some anxiety, man finds himself before that chaos which he has covered up, denied, forgotten, or thought was tamed. Cinematography apprises him of a monster. And while much has changed about our thinking on the sublime since Burke and Kant, modernist poetics keeps this idea of the disturbing, and hence potentially renewing, quality of the sublime in art and nature. The encounter with the monstrous sublime should change you. And for Epstein, this encounter occurs in scientific cinematography, magnification, or photogenie more generally. Second, we should note that it is not the actor who gives power to the close-up, but the camera. The camera is the real star, the real artist for Epstein. It sees the world in its own way, one different than ours. Epstein asks, why refuse to profit by one of the rarest qualities of the cinematic eye, that of being an eye independent of the eye? Of escaping the tyrannical egocentrism of our personal vision? Why compel the sensitive emulsion simply to duplicate the functions of our own retina? Why not grasp eagerly at an almost unique opportunity to set a scene from a focus other than our own line of sight? The lens is itself. The lens is not a mere extension or prosthesis of our eyes. It is a thing that views differently. It is not part of us. It is other than us. There is an intelligence to the machine. And this is remarkably similar to Walter Benjamin's notion of the optical unconscious. Both theorists speak to the otherness of the camera, to the radically different quality evoked by the sublime in scientific cinematography. Here's Benjamin's famous passage. For it is another nature which speaks to the camera rather than to the eye, other above all in the sense that the space informed by human consciousness gives way to a space informed by the unconscious. Whereas it is a commonplace that, for example, we have some idea of what is involved in the act of walking, if only in general terms, we have no idea at all what happens during the fraction of a second when a person actually takes a step. Photography, with its devices of slow motion and enlargement, reveals the secret. It is through photography that we first discover the existence of this optical unconscious. just as we discover the instinctual unconscious through psychoanalysis. Details of structure, cellular tissue, with which technology and medicine are normally concerned, all this is, in its origins, more native to the camera than the atmospheric landscape or the soulful portrait. Here, Benjamin speaks of the otherness of the camera and the world it depicts through the metaphor of the unconscious. What do they have in common? Both magnification and psychoanalysis imply a limitlessness. Both are techniques that plumb the infinite abyss. You simply don't know how far the camera or the psychiatrist can go, and this makes us uneasy. But there is something else that suggests the radical quality of these tools. The camera captures events that would not otherwise be visible. It is not merely that these events are difficult to observe without the camera. In a real sense, they do not exist without it. That is, what we know of them depends on the technology we use to represent them. These events are revealed to us by cinematography, in the same way that our unconscious is revealed by and comes into being by virtue of psychoanalysis. So there is more to magnification than a rhetoric of revelation. There's a creative aspect to it as well. And this is perhaps why Epstein and Benjamin find in scientific cinematography an emblem of, even a ground for, aesthetic and historical renewal. Hannah Landecker has also shown the importance of microcinematography for film theory as a theme that runs throughout the discussions of the close-up. But I find that putting Epstein and Benjamin under the compound microscope of magnification and the sublime allows us to see especially clearly the importance of both for their conception of cinema. For Epstein and Benjamin, magnification of both space and time dramatizes the radically alternative vision that cinema provides. It disturbs and transforms, and thus holds the potential for a rethinking of our orderly universe. Scientific cinematography offers a new approach to time and the everyday, and this can be the basis of a radical, materialist vision of history. So when, in his work of art essay, Benjamin speaks of the dynamite of the split second, he slyly hints at the revolutionary potential of magnification. Thank you.